live from the WJF studios in Liberty, New York. This is Radio Chatville. I'm Tim Bruno. On today's show, Friday, the Black Library is hosting their second Artist in Residence group show, and this time they're featuring students from Monticello High School. The Black Library is the creative space in the village of Monticello dedicated to honoring and celebrating Black history and culture. We'll speak to one of the co-founders of the library, Douglas Schindler. The New York City Department of Environmental Protection held a meeting in Hancock to learn more about the Delaware Act shutdown yesterday and the potential impacts to the Upper Delaware. We'll speak to friends of the Upper Delaware for an update. Plus, what's happening at the Cooperage in Honesdale this summer. And the circus is coming to Highland Lake on Friday. All that and more. But first, the news from NPR.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Attorneys for former President Donald Trump and two co-defendants will attend a court hearing in Florida today. Trump is charged with taking classified and top-secret information after he left the White House in 2021. He was also charged with taking part in a conspiracy to hide documents from federal investigators. NPR's Greg Allen reports Trump's legal team is expected to ask the judge in the case to dismiss the charges.
There's nearly a dozen motions to dismiss the case that were filed by Trump, his co-defendants that are still pending. Two are being heard today, and they were filed by Trump aide Walt Nauta. In one, he says he's the victim of a selective and vindictive prosecution. The other motion says prosecutor's case is a personal and political attack against Trump, and that the indictment doesn't have a plain summary of the alleged crimes with Trump and his co-defendants are charged.
That's NPR's Greg Allen reporting. The Associated Press resumed its live shot of Gaza from Israel today. That was after the Israeli Communications Ministry seized the equipment they used to broadcast the feed. NPR's Hadil Al-Shalchi reports from Tel Aviv.
The AP live shot shows a skyline of Gaza buildings with occasional plumes of smoke billowing from the fighting. And it's back online after briefly being taken down by Israeli authorities. On Tuesday, officials arrived at an AP location and seized a camera, modem, and other equipment. Israel said the AP was violating a new Israeli media law by providing images to Al Jazeera. Israel has had a tense relationship with the Qatari-funded Al Jazeera for years and banned the network from the country at the beginning of May. After pressure from the White House and widespread coverage in Israeli media, the Ministry of Communications returned the equipment to the AP. Hadil Al-Shalchi, NPR News, Tel Aviv.
Stocks on Wall Street opened mostly lower this morning as discount retailer Target reported a drop in sales. NPR's Scott Horsley reports the Dow Jones Industrial Average slipped about 30 points in early trading.
Target says its sales dropped more than 3% in the most recent quarter, and profits fell short of analyst expectations. Earlier this week, the retailer announced widespread price cuts on essentials like milk and diapers in a bid to get more shoppers in the door. Stock market darling NVIDIA, which designs computer chips used in AI, is set to report its quarterly earnings later today. Sales of existing homes fell slightly last month, but home prices continue to climb. The National Association of Realtors says the average home sold for just over $407,000 in April. A shortage of homes on the market is keeping prices elevated. One in three homes sold last month went to a first-time buyer. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow was down 28 points, the Nasdaq up 9. This is NPR. Officials are assessing the damage across parts of the Midwest after a series of powerful storms ripped across the region on Tuesday. Tornadoes touched down in southwest Iowa, leaving several communities in ruins. Officials say multiple people died in the storms. Forecasters say the threat of severe weather will continue through Thursday for parts of the plains and Midwest. As temperatures hit the triple digits in Phoenix, Arizona, seasonal heat relief sites have started opening. Catherine Davis-Young from member station KJZZ reports the city is also planning to run a 24-hour cooling center for the first time this year.
Across the Phoenix area for decades, there's been a patchwork system of charitable organizations, churches, and public buildings that serve as cooling centers, but none of them offered 24/7 access. Now, a room in the city's central library is staying open at all hours through September. David Hondula with the city's Office of Heat Response and Mitigation hopes it will have a big public health impact.
I think we might see fewer 911 calls in those overnight and extended hours, but I think we might even see fewer 911 calls the next morning or the next afternoon.
The plan comes after a record-shattering 645 heat-related deaths last year. Officials found one-third of heat-related 911 calls came during hours when cooling centers were closed. For NPR News, I'm Catherine Davis-Young in Phoenix.
Stocks continue to trade mixed on Wall Street. The Dow was down 27 points. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. And the listeners who support this NPR station.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The shutdown to repair the Delaware Aqueduct is set for October 1st and scheduled to be completed by June of next year. As we've been reporting, the twice-postponed project seeks to repair a minor leak near Warwissing in Ulster County and a major leak under the Hudson River, which is the path to get the Delaware River water from upstate to New York City. Friends of the Upper Delaware invited the New York City Department of Environmental Protection to a meeting in Hancock yesterday to learn more about this shutdown and more specifically about the potential impacts to the Upper Delaware River. Joining us now is Jeff Skelding, president of Friends of the Upper Delaware River, and they organized the meeting yesterday. Good morning, Jeff.
Good morning, Jim. Thanks for having me back.
Well, and thanks for being here and let us know about that meeting yesterday. Did you feel like you got some answers to a lot of your questions? We'll go through some of them, but how overall did you find the presentation and the information?
Yeah, it was a really great meeting. We had a very good turnout. We had probably over 50 people between those in the room and those on the Zoom. We did it both ways. So, the city focused its comments on the Upper Delaware impacts, and there was lots of questions and good discussion.
So some of those questions I just want to go through. We had talked about this on Monday. Some of the questions you had and people that also had in the audience, so will there be an impact on water releases?
Yeah, that's the big overall question, of course. And in addition to flooding in communities, that's how it breaks out. An interesting dichotomy here between, the impact on the cold water fishery below the dams and the potential impacts of flooding in the local communities. And so you have different interest groups that are focused on different concerns. And it's really a balancing act for everybody, but particularly for the city in terms of how they get ready to ultimately shut down the aqueduct and to manage water releases and reservoir levels.
Did they address how local communities can be assured that flood risks are minimized? Did they offer some assurances?
Yeah, they did. They feel like the environmental review work that they've done years past now, I mean, this project's been going on for many years now, does factor in the potential for, big storms coming in that might fill up the reservoirs, which now, once the project commences, you're eliminating, there's three ways for the water to go. It either spills over the dam, it's released from the bottom of the dam, or it's diverted to New York City for water supply. And it's the diversions that they're shutting down completely, because the aqueduct has to be empty and dry for them to do the work. So they just eliminated one big mechanism that removes water from the reservoir. And so, if a big rain comes and fills it up, you start to worry about flooding. They feel like their modeling work and their analysis work, they feel pretty assured that, that things should be okay. But in all fairness, there are people that are also looking at historic weather patterns and, people who live below the dams or local communities and local elected officials, they still certainly have some concerns. So it is, there's still a risk factor here.
Also, hurricane season officially begins June 1st, and they're forecasting 23 named storms, 11 hurricanes, and 5 major hurricanes. That's well above the seasonal average. And, you know, believe it or not, up here in the mountains, we still have to look at hurricanes coming up the East Coast.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So that, I mean, that's, and they remember that the city in its regular management of these reservoirs, even when the aqueduct isn't shut down, it, you know, they factor in the potentiality of big storms in terms of how they manage the reservoirs. They will be drawing down the reservoirs, right, to compensate for the elimination of the diversion for water supply to the city for 8 months. So they will be drawing down the reservoirs as they lead up to October 1st. And of course, the idea there is to build a sort of a void or a buffer in the reservoir in the event of a large storm. So that's happening, and that's a major approach they're taking to try to address the concern of flooding.
When will the pre-construction drawdown of the reservoirs begin?
Very soon, I think. I think we're looking probably around June 1st. But again, I know I've said this to you before, Tim, but everything up here depends on weather. Mm-hmm. There are different scenarios based on very dry summer versus a very wet summer versus a normal summer. So there are going to be variations in start times and, you know, how much they draw down the reservoir and what the water releases might be. And a lot of that's going to be based on modeling and weather forecasting that goes out 1 week, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, and a month, you know. And the further you get out on weather forecasting, the less reliable it is.
Did they address the target level for reservoir storage volume on October 1st when the shutdown's supposed to begin? We talked about this a little bit on Monday, but if you can remind folks what the target level for reservoir storage volume means, and did they answer that?
Yeah, it sounds like the number, we keep hearing the number 70% full or 30% down. For each of the three Delaware reservoirs, which are, as a reminder, are Cannonsville, Pepacton, and Neversink reservoirs. These are the reservoirs we're talking about here. And it sounds like they're shooting for a 70 or 30% void by the time we get to October 1st.
And the other thing that we talked about Monday, too, were the go, no-go considerations for launching or postponing the project. On Monday, you said, well, we know they have these considerations. Were they able to share those yesterday at the meeting?
Yeah, I think the biggest one, you know, in the previous years, there's been a supply line problem in terms of getting certain equipment, or there was certain equipment that actually turned out not to be the right equipment. Those were the reasons why we had a no-go last year and the year before. I think it sounds like those have all been corrected. And the biggest no-go that we talked about yesterday, or that the city talked about, was, again, a very wet forecast for the summer. That could, you know, if it does threaten, you know, if they feel like there's a flooding potential, that would be one of the top no-go considerations.
And then also the reservoirs, once this is completed next year, do they address how they'll be managed when the project's coming to a close and when it's completed?
Yeah, and that's a big question we have. When we think about the angling and the angling economy here, we're already thinking about next spring, you know, when the fishing season starts. And we're a little worried that if they draw those reservoirs down too low, what will that mean for being able to fill them up in the spring? And if they're challenged to fill them up, then that means the releases into the river might be lower than normal, which is not a good story for the angling experience below the dams. So that's one thing we are thinking about. The other thing they're doing, of course, is before they shut down on October 1st, they're drawing heavily from the Delaware system or water supply from New York, because they won't be able to do that after October 1st, and they won't be able to do that for 8 months after October 1st. And so their ultimate goal is to balance their entire system, which, remember, includes reservoirs in the Catskill system in addition to the Delaware system, mm-hmm. and also down in Westchester County area and Croton system. They're trying to manage them all in a way that they all sort of equally calibrate ultimately as we approach the spring. So that's a management goal of theirs. But again, it is so difficult you know, as the city often says, they don't have a crystal ball. And when they say that, they're really referring to weather. You know, what is the weather going to do?
You mentioned that it was a pretty good turnout, about 50 or so people there. Were there some other questions from the audience that stuck out to you?
Yeah, I think what stuck out to me is what's we've been wrestling with, and I know the city wrestles with this too, is you have different constituencies with different concerns. And, you know, on the polar end, I mentioned a moment ago, you know, the angling community, you know, enjoys this world-class wild trout fishery that is really important to the economy of the region and the tourism, the burgeoning tourism growth that we see here. And that requires water in the river. You know, there's sort of a general desire on the part of the angling community to have more water is better than less water. But, you know, for the people that live here and the local elected officials that have to manage their highways and their bridges and their culverts, more water can also mean flooding. So you have these very sort of polarized viewpoints on water management, and it's really challenging to kind of find that middle spot. And I think that's what we're all trying to do. We want to make sure that, you know, this, at all times, not just during this project, but especially during this project where it can really kind of upset, you know, certain elements of water management, you know, can we adequately and sufficiently satisfy the needs of the river and the fishery and all that does for the community, but also make sure there's not, you know, too much water that's going to cause, you know, the kind of flooding we saw in the early 2000s, which is still fresh in the memories of many people around here.
Did you feel that at the conclusion of the meeting, those different stakeholders were satisfied with the conversation and the meeting?
By and large, I did. I felt like they really appreciated the city's genuine efforts to talk openly and transparently about the project, to explain why. It's a very complicated project. I think they did a pretty good job of focusing on the upper river, which we asked them to do, and to kind of explain how what's happening and how it all works. You know, having said that, there are still people with doubts in the crowd, and they were asking some tough questions about, you know, particularly about the flooding concerns that was, you know, that is so high on the mind of many. And there's just, you know, there's just some uncertainty for people who went through that flooding in the early part of, or in the early 2000s, 04, 05, and 06. You know, that's an indelible memory. And so they're going to come in with a, you know, some really high level concerns about that that aren't easily dispatched, especially in a situation where you don't have all the answers. Mm-hmm. Because again, the variables are so, there are a number of unknown variables. Again, mostly based on what's the weather going to be like this summer.
And did they mention if they're having any more meetings or guide folks to where they could get more information? I know that on the city's website, nyc.gov, there's a big fact sheet, lots of information there. Did they address any other sort of community?
Yeah, go to the city's website for starters. They told us the presentation that they did is available to the public, and we as an FUDR also have it. We recorded the whole thing, and we will have it available as well. And then they also they realized that it's not like you get to October 1st and then there's no need to come around anymore, right? This it's an 8-month project, and there's going to be developments probably on a weekly basis that need to be addressed, whether it's weather or equipment or something. You know, it's a very enormous, complex project. So they have committed to staying in touch with us and keeping us updated and coming back if they need to.
Yeah, and just to put it in perspective, the water supply for New York City comes from these three separate reservoir systems, the Croton, Catskill, and Delaware systems, providing 1.1 billion gallons of drinking water each day to nearly 10 million people, including those in New York City and communities north of the city. It's the largest municipal water supply system in the United States. So a huge project, the largest tunnel in the United States to get that water down. So as we've said, a very complicated system, and a lot of it dependent on the weather. We'll keep tabs on it, and Jeff will have you back if you hear anything else. Thanks for joining us and keeping us updated on this meeting and what else is going on with the shutdown.
Absolutely. I appreciate it, Tim, and I'll come back anytime you need me.
All right. Thank you. All right. We'll take a break, and when we come back, We'll talk to Douglas Schindler, one of the co-founders of the Black Library, about their latest artist in residence group show, this time featuring students. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Next time on the Retro Cocktail Hour, we got bongo beaters galore, including Chocolate, Chaino, and Jack Bongo Burger. I'm Darryl Brogdon. Join me where the music's always shaken, not stirred. The Retro Cocktail Hour.
Coming up tonight at 7 on Radio Catskill.
This is Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Black Library is a creative space in the village of Monticello dedicated to honoring and celebrating Black history and culture. This Friday at 6, the Black Library is hosting their second Artists in Residence group show, and this time featuring students from Monticello High School. Joining us is one of the co-founders of the Black Library, Douglas Schindler, to tell us more. Good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. And let's remind folks about your inspiration to start the Black Library and this Artist in Residence program. It's the second one that you've had so far.
Yeah. So, I mean, the Black Library is a library and community art space focused on celebrating and educating on Black history and culture. You know, what really inspired us to start it was the fact that, you know, we don't have too many outlets in Monticello or really in Sullivan County. So, you know, we're really trying to make a space that gives people the opportunity to do more than, you know, just sit around and do nothing or, you know, potentially get into drug abuse or all these kinds of things that have been going wrong with our county for so long. We're really trying to make a big change and just give people a safe space to be, create, you know, and educate, you know.
Yeah. How did you guys decide to focus on students this time for this Artists in Residence program?
Well, the first one we had, it was all adult artists, kind of like early career. And, you know, we're really focused on giving people a spotlight that might not have those opportunities or might not know where to find those opportunities to find that spotlight to put on themselves. So, you know, we really found a bunch of more like unknown artists around our county that we know about for the first show. And then, you know, we really wanted to give students a spotlight, too, because we know that a lot of students are really, really talented, really, really skilled when it comes to creating their art. So we wanted to kind of shine the spotlight on that as well. And, you know, let them know what people didn't really let us know as artists. You know, I'm an artist. Mike, my co-founder, is an artist. And not too many people were telling us that that art was a viable career. So we just want to really not just tell the students that art is a viable career and kind of just, like, show them that art is important, that you can make a living through art. And that was what was so important to us, to have a resident group that was all students.
How were they selected?
So we did the same thing that we did with the adults. We had them go through an application process. This time it was a little bit different. We did go to Monticello High School, and we were kind of there all day. We reviewed some portfolios at the end of the day. You know, we gave kind of like a lecture on what the Black Library is, who me and Mike are as people and as artists, and then let them know about art school and how to apply for art school, what they'll need, and all that stuff. And then we review their portfolios at the end of the day. So the art teachers at Monticello all helped us a lot. Kind of, they narrowed down a group of a bunch of students that they thought might be interested. And then a bunch of those students applied for the residency, and then we selected from there.
I don't know about your experience, but in my experience, high school students can sometimes be shy and not too communicative. How are they responding to this, especially seeing artists like yourself coming in and then reviewing their portfolios? How did they respond to just even that part of it to, you know, as you said, see that art is this option, this pathway?
Well, I think a lot of them responded really well, and a lot of them were pretty talkative, and you wouldn't really know that some of them were really shy. A few of them in particular are actually like really, really shy. But during the review, they were talking a lot. But, you know, Mike and I made sure that we were asking them a lot of questions about their artwork to try and get them to open up, and then giving them a lot of, you know, positive reinforcement about their artwork. But it's not even that we were just like trying to be positive. Some of them were just like really so good. That there's nothing negative to say. Like one of our resident artists, she's really, really shy, but she's been opening up even like throughout this residency, you know, talking with us more and more. And I mean, when I first seen her work, I was like, okay, we have to have her as one of our residents, because in terms of just like technical ability, she's so incredible. So, yeah.
Can you describe her work a little bit, and then also some work of some of the other artists?
Yeah, so her work is very figurative. You know, she does a lot of portraits of people, a lot of full body portraits of people. But her proportions are just so excellent that it kind of like blew me away when I first seen her work. But they're very like bright, colorful portraits of people. And a lot of the time they're more so not so much in, like set in a place or time. It's kind of just like, it'll be like more abstract background sometimes with a portrait on top of that. Some of the other artists' work are, more like objects and things. Some of them are kind of abstract in that there are figures and eyes and objects that we know, but they're kind of floating. And then there's some like animals and things of nature, landscapes, the usual stuff. One of them actually does crochet and does a little bit of fiber work and jewelry making as well. And I think that she'll have some of that stuff on display also.
I'm just wondering about how, when you look at this from your perspective as, you know, the co-founder of the library and artist yourself, you know, curating this and guiding these artists in residence, can you speak a little bit about how the adult viewpoint compares a little bit with the youth viewpoint? Are you seeing youth finding these ways of expressing themselves and also expressing their experiences in a similar or a different way?
That's kind of a tough question. Yeah. I think that
I'm just wondering, because, you know, there are some folks that are, as folks practice more and as you grow into your art, they can become more articulate about what they're trying to focus on and what they're trying to provoke. And I'm wondering if in the inexperience of the youth here, are you still seeing something like that? It's just not maybe they haven't found the words for it.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think that a lot of the times, it's like a lot of the times when I see it, it's kind of like one or the other. When it comes to the youth, they're either like really doing a lot of stuff that focuses on developing technical ability, or their technical ability might be lacking a little bit, but they're really focused on expressing themselves. And then some of the youth have both, of course, too. But I see a lot of parallels, honestly, about, between the adults and the youth, with kind of like having a hard time to really, really get themselves into the paintings. So that's sort of like development work that needs to be done. And then professional development, of course, is another parallel that was needed for both groups. Just like learning about, you know, an artist bio, artist statement, CV, where do you find grants? How do you apply to these grants? That's a parallel between, you know, a lot of local adult artists and local youth artists. But of course, like the high school students are thinking about college as well. And some of them kind of needed a little bit of a confidence boost in terms of, thinking about going to art school or like, should I go to art school? Should I only take art classes? Those kinds of things. And then a few of them have asked us to help them find scholarships and stuff too to help pay for school.
So, yeah. Is that one of the other students too?
Actually, it's just needing a little bit of confidence in different areas.
Yeah, know? And you're providing that space for them as well. Is that one of the impacts you mentioned? Confidence and maybe just kind of looking forward to possibly pursuing this as a career or dedicating more time to it. Is that one of the impacts you hope this residency program has on these young artists?
Definitely, and I feel like it's already starting to have that kind of impact. You know, I feel like the residency had a huge impact on the adult artists. You know, some of them had immediately, you know, started finding more art-based jobs, like more art-based gigs, more art-based jobs, and just, you know, getting to create for money. And then just, you know, seeing how well that first group show went for them, I think kind of sparked something too, where they were like, okay, you know, this is kind of what I needed to keep going. And then I think the youth artists, hopefully, you know, hopefully this turnout will be really well and a lot of people will be interested in their work. That's what we're gunning for. And hopefully that will kind of give them a spark to like, okay, maybe I should do this. Whereas like the adults was like, I should keep going. The youth will be like, maybe I should, you know, leap into this and see what happens.
Yeah. And again, the Black Library Artists in Residence Group Show 2 is Friday from 6 to 9 at the Black Library in Monticello, featuring the students of Monticello High School. There's more information at theblacklibraryny.com. Before we go, Douglas, are there some other events coming up this summer you want to mention?
Yeah. Well, of course, we always have our open mics are twice a month. That's actually tomorrow, I believe.
Yep, tomorrow the 23rd. Yep.
and then we have June 28th, we have our next live music show, which is going to be Latin music, Latin dance music. They play music from like Brazil and Spain and a few other places. So that'll be a really cool show. We'll probably have that set up in a way where people can get up and move, get up and dance to the music. And then, of course, for August, August will be our you know, 1 year anniversary of, you know, being open in the space. So we're planning some pretty big events for our like 1 year anniversary of having the space.
Oh, good. Well, we'll have you back to talk about that as we get a little closer. And then if folks want to, you know, support this event and the Black Library, are you still doing book donations or other donations?
Yeah, we have book donations open. You know, you can find more information about book donations on our website at theblacklibraryny.com. And then we also have, you know, a monetary donation portal on our website. All of that stuff is under the donation tab on our website. Yeah, we're always accepting books. People can just kind of walk in with the books. We're right on Broadway at the old Key Bank building. Yeah,
you can't miss it. There's some great artwork in the windows there, too. So,
yeah,
that's Douglas Schindler. He's one of the co-founders of the Black Library in Monticello. Their second Artists in Residence group show featuring students from Monticello High School is Friday. Douglas, thanks for joining us and have a great event.
Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. We'll take a break. And when we come back, what's happening at the Cooperage in Honesdale? This is Radio Chatskill.
I'm Maria Hinojosa, this week on Latino USA. The story of untreated severe mental illness and Edward Cordero, the young man who pushed another man to his death off a New York City subway. That's this week on Latino USA.
Thursday afternoon at 1 on Radio Catskill.
Mixtape's all about eclectic music, compiled with love, like an old school mixtape. I'm Jason Tuga, and every Friday night, it's my aim to bring you something special, a unique mix of music you wouldn't hear anywhere else. You can count on hearing a diverse range of artists, eras, genres, and vibes. The Mixtape, an hour of music assembled by me just for you, Friday night.
Friday night at 7 on Radio Catskill.
You're listening to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The Cooperage Project in Hodesdale has all kinds of activities planned for the summer, and we're going to talk to someone who's a little new to the Cooperage to learn more. It's Bonnie Matthews, the new communications manager for the Cooperage Project. Good morning.
Hey, Tim. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Well, thanks for coming over to Liberty from Hodesdale. You said you had a nice drive.
Yes. I'm just getting my feet wet in the area.
So. I know. So I just wanted, before we get into some of the events, you're the new communications manager. You're new to the area. You're really new to the area. Where did you move from again?
Well, I moved from California and had a little short stay in Virginia first. And yeah, so I'm really new.
What brought you to the Northeast Pennsylvania, Upper Delaware area?
You know, I have a friend from art school who has a place in Beach Lake. And so I've been up to this area over the years. And I thought, you know, may as well try something new. Why not?
Yeah. And you found the Cooperage, and the Cooperage found you.
That's right. Thanks to Instagram. Yeah.
Is that really how you found them?
Literally. Yeah. Wow. I've been freelancing most of my life. And when I moved up here, I thought, gosh, you know, I wonder how I could just jump into the community up here. And I thought, well, let me look at Instagram. And lo and behold, they had an application on Instagram. And I thought, wow, the Cooperage Project just seems amazing.
It is.
Yeah. So I've only been there like just 2 months.
Wow. That is really amazing.
Awesome.
Like, you were looking for something. You happened to see this. This all sort of aligned.
Yeah. It's so great. I mean, it's awesome because it's forced me out in the community, like meeting you guys. And you know, it's just awesome since I didn't really have any friends up this way, you know.
Well, when you get to the Cooperage, you're going to have some instant friends. There's lots of people moving through there for all these great events. So let's talk about some of the things that are coming up. I know that you've got a couple of different happenings, including there's a contra dance coming up this weekend.
Yeah, it's really cool. That's really fun. It's for any age, and you can. They have at 7:15. We've got like a little class ahead of time if you don't know what's going on. They've got like a live caller. And
oh, good,
because
I don't know what's going on. Contra dance is like a called type thing.
Yeah, it's awesome.
Yeah,
and so you know, a lot of our programs are free or with a donation, suggested donation. So y'all should come out for that.
And then the big thing that you're working on, I know, is the Cooperage Follies.
Yes.
That's coming up June 1st. So talk about the Cooperage Follies and what this is all about.
Well, you know, we're a nonprofit, and so we get a lot of our funding from grants and some of our programs. And so every once in a while we do fundraisers. So the Cooperage Follies is just a fun spring fundraiser. And we're having a lot of local VIPs come. They're going to do some really fun vaudeville acts. And there's going to be some a lot of the VIPs are doing just crazy acts. I don't want to give too much away.
Do you have a couple that you can talk about? Or?
Well, we're doing little teasers with the local VIPs.
I've seen a couple of those
on
social media.
So, on Instagram, we're kind of teasing them out. So I'm going to just let you explore there to see what's going
okay,
on.
Okay, okay.
But it's awesome. We've got about 35 tickets left, you guys.
Okay.
But yeah, it's really fun. And people will be able to vote for their favorite acts and stuff. It should be a fun night.
And you've got, like, I think this is the mayor of Hodesdale coming and those kinds of VIPs.
The mayor's going to be doing an act, and it's going to be fun.
Okay. What else do you have coming up on the schedule?
Well, we just wrapped up our winter farmers market, and we're getting ready to roll out our Northern Poconos mobile farmers market. We don't have that launched yet. This is our second season. So that'll be coming up in June. And then also in June, we've got three June Pride celebrations. We're going to, it's going to be cool. We've got, we have a All Pride, No Prejudice picnic. It's for all ages. It's free. And that should be fun. It's from 12 to 4 on the 8th of June. And we're going to have a drag bingo, And we do that a couple of times a year, but and it's really popular, so it does sell out quickly.
And I think I'd just like to note that live musical performances from popular performers Polly Vinyl Chord and Basic Bitches
is coming.
And Polly Vinyl Chord, we know, coming back. So we're happy to see her come back.
Yeah, that's going to be super fun.
And then you've got the whole month of celebrations. So the next one is the third annual Pride Karaoke on the 14th.
Yep, from 7 to 10. And that one's a $5 suggested donation. And this is our third year in a row for that. It should be fun.
And then you mentioned the drag bingo coming up on the 29th.
Yep.
All right. Also, some you always have some good stuff for the youth, as I say. The Teen Art Lounge, the 14th. The Cooper Project really dedicated to youth programming. I know that there's the pop-up club afterwards. You have a new space that you've developed there, too, for youth programs. Let's talk a little bit about the youth programs coming out.
So back to the space real quick. Some of our programs, we have several pop-up programs. Some are happening at our new Stoneworks building that's right behind the Cooper building. And then some of them are out at other locations in Wayne County and other areas. But the Teen Art Lounge that's coming up on the 14th is super cool. It's going to start out for grades 6 to 12, and it starts at the Stoneworks, and then people are going to walk across the street to the Wayne County Arts Alliance Gallery, and they're going to be able to see John Cash's illustrations and drawings. And then at the gallery, and then they're going to come back and do a really cool illustration workshop.
Yeah, and it's a kind of a caricature type
thing.
Yes,
it's going to be great. So that one, you do have to pre-register for that. So if you go on our website, thecooperageproject.org, which is new, by the way, we just relaunched.
is that you're doing?
Actually, no, that was started during the pandemic, but they finally got it off the ground. So we're going to be tweaking it a little bit in the next couple
great.
Of months. But yeah, thanks.
Yeah.
So
and then the Stoneworks Youth Center, I just want to go back to that for a second. Last time we were there, I was there, got a little tour of it. It's right next door, right behind the main Cooperage building there on Main Street. And such a great space because it's just when you walk in, you realize, oh, this is all dedicated for youth. This is like specific. You can see like the special like places for them, but like it's just nice to know that there's this like one space completely dedicated to them there in the community.
It's really awesome. We've got space for microgreens and romping radishes. A whole bunch of different age group events happen there, and it's a 2-story building. It's even got like a little kitchenette in there. So yeah, all kinds of activities. We also have an outside area that's enclosed for outside activities, for teaching kids about plants and stuff. And a lot of visitors can come and do classes there. It's great.
Okay. What else do you have on the agenda you want to let folks know about that is going on this summer at the Cooperage?
Well, we actually have one other really cool thing happening. We have a sound bath experience happening.
What's that?
Let's see. Where is that? I just lost my notes. It is. It's so cool. This Kaylin of Earth, she's going to be doing all kinds of sound bowls. She's a certified sound therapist. Mm-hmm. And you come and just chill out and listen to that. It's a whole exciting experience. That's actually June 20th.
Summer solstice.
Yes, exactly.
All right.
So that's going to be cool. And then we actually have a special screening of a critically acclaimed limited released documentary called Your Fat Friend by this woman.
Say again?
It's called Your Fat Friend.
Okay.
And it's a documentary film. It took 6 years to make. And the woman, her name is Jeannie Finlay, she started just blogging as just living the life of a fat person in our society. And she ended up getting this film made, and it got into the Tribeca Film Festival and Sheffield Dockets, et cetera, et cetera. So we're really excited to be one of the very few people, the very few organizations that are going to get the live screening. So y'all should come to that July 18th. It's amazing.
July 18th. All right. Yep. And there's more information at thecooperageproject.org and also on the Facebook page. Before you go, Bonnie, are you, there's some things that you're like, hoping to do more of? I know you're just getting your feet wet. You've been only there a couple of months, but, you know, the Cooperage always focused on performances and good times. What are some of the good time things that you're hoping to bring to the Cooperage yourself?
Well, I've already done one thing, which is, I was a guest for one of the, Children's Book Week events at the Stoneworks Youth Building, and I was able to share with the kids what it's like to be a children's book illustrator. So that was super fun.
Because that's what you did?
Yeah, I've done that for like 20 some years.
Wow.
And
you just mentioned freelancing. You didn't mention that part.
Well, I've done a bunch of different things. You know, I like to always change it up a little.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was really cool. And you know, being an artist, there's so many artists in the Sullivan County and Wayne County, so I'm excited to just dive in and see what happens there.
All right. Bonnie Matthews is the new communications manager at the Cooperage Project. Well, welcome to the community. And if you see her over at the Cooperage, say hi. She might be wearing one of her colorful shirts. She's got one of them today. Thank you, Bonnie.
Thank you so much, Tim. Appreciate it.
Okay, we'll take a quick break, and we're going to go join the circus. The circus coming to NACL in Highland Lake on Friday. We'll have a preview next. This is Radio Chatskill.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Jeff Works Office Solutions, located right on Main Street in Jeffersonville, New York, a newly renovated pet-friendly office space that rents by the day, week, or month, with hot desks, sound-insulated rooms, Wi-Fi, modern amenities, and 24-hour secure access. Online at jeffworksjville.com. And from The Cooperage Project, thecooperageproject.org, and listeners like you who donate at wjffradio.org.
Hey, it's Francis Lamb, host of The Splendid Table. This week, we've got interviews that will put a couple of great books on your summer reading list. We're talking about the poetry of food and the life of the legendary Judith Jones, who brought Julia Child back to America. That's coming up on The Splendid Table.
The Splendid Table, Sunday morning at 11, on Radio Catskill.
Welcome back to Radio Chatskill. I'm Tim Bruno. The circus is coming to Highland Lake on Friday. NACL is welcoming performers, artists, and technicians of Hideaway Circus for a second year. They're sharing a preview of their next original show, Canvas Sky. And joining us now with a preview of that preview are Josh Avner from Hideaway Circus and Brett Kaiser of NACL. Hi, good morning.
Hi, Tim.
It's a little wacky echo there, but if you guys want to pull up a closer to the mic there.
Yeah.
There we go. Tell us, Josh, about Hideaway Circus a little bit, will you?
Sure. So my wife and I have been producing circus and dance shows since 2016. Mm-hmm. My background is in circus. I ran away from regular life when I was a kid and found an organization called Circus Mercus, which is based in Vermont, and started touring with them at the age of 13. And ever since, we've been stuck in the circus world, so to speak. My wife and I had a dance show that was happening off-Broadway that got shut down during COVID on March 13th, along with everything else getting shut down. And we spent a year being like, what do we do next? And the answer was, let's make an outdoor touring circus. So we're now in our fourth year of this this circus and touring. And this is our second year going to the North American Cultural Lab, where we do a residency for 2 weeks where we create the show, and we'll open it on Friday and then tour it for 35 weeks around the country.
Now, out of the COVID experience, a lot of people did some different things and chose different paths or tried new things, baked bread, bought a Peloton. You started a circus.
Yes. It was always our goal, but it just felt like now's the moment. You know, Cirque du Soleil had shut down, Ringling had shut down, Big Apple Circus had shut down. So we had no competition at the time. And my wife and I met at grad school for theater producing, and I wrote my thesis on why touring with tents is a bad idea. And this was our perfect chance to turn that thesis into reality and tour, you know, outdoors. And so, as a big circus nerd, there's a circus in America has been here since George Washington. And between 1770 and 1825, there were no circus tents. You were just touring outdoors in the open air in these areas. And I was like, let's just do a modern version of 250 years ago.
So you call yourselves a new kind of American circus. What do you mean by that? Tell us
sure.
about the circus and the ethos of...
So we have no animals in our show. And my wife's background is musical theater. So it's very much infused with things that come from the theater world, like a basic story, character development, And then we, in the circus, there's two kinds of ways to describe style. There's traditional circus, which is more like Ringling Brothers, or what you might imagine when you smell sawdust and go to a tent. And there's what we call contemporary circus, which is what you might see at your performing arts center that's from Sweden or from Australia and is a bit more avant-garde and like dance. And we try to blend the two. So depending on whatever you like in circus, you'll see some style of that in our show.
And also there's a message of self-acceptance and uplifting each other in your, well, in this performance, but also, I guess, overall.
Yeah, for sure. So every year when we make a show, we try to talk about something that we feel is in the zeitgeist. And this year's theme is really about loving yourself, or when you have self-doubt, how do you find self-confidence? And doing that through friendship and through community. So you'll see the clown struggling to love himself and find his confidence, and the rest of the circus cast helps him realize how special he is.
Oh, wow. And that's Canvas Sky, which is Friday. And we called it a preview. So this is sort of, as NACL does, provides a space for folks to sort of workshop their ideas. Can you tell us a little bit about how you came to NACL? And
yeah, for sure. So it's quite hard to rehearse a circus show because we have 20 people.
Imagine, yeah.
We need a massive field. We need an indoor theater space when it's raining to practice in. And we need housing for some of our artists and our company members. We do travel with trucks and trailers. And we need it to be within relatively close distance from New York City, which is where all of our equipment is rented from. So NACL fits that bubble amazing ways. And I stumbled across them last year. And once we found them and did this the first time, it was just a no-brainer to return.
Yeah, and Brett, we're having a little trouble with your mic, so I'm gonna. Okay. There we go. When you found the circus, what did you think about that for NACL?
Oh well, I've loved circus forever. I thought it was an amazing thing, and you know, we talked about it for about 2 minutes and said, "Yep, let's do it." All of those ingredients that Josh was mentioning are things that we have most of those things at NACL, with the exception of the big field. And this event really is a special thing for us and for Highland Lake because it's about neighbors coming together. So Shane and Larry Fishman, who are our neighbors, have that big gigantic field, which is requisite for rehearsing and putting up a show. And they have very generously let the circus set up and for the last 2 years, do their show on their property. We also have neighbors who have opened up their parking lot, spaces on their land for cars. And that's one, if you've ever been to Highland Lake, it's a tiny little hamlet. So there are no parking spaces per se. And so we actually have to say, if you are coming, we encourage you to carpool so people can see the show.
And how has it been for the audience reaction? I mean, NACL does so many great experimental, I would say, unusual, unique, however you want to characterize it, different types of art. How's it been the reaction having a circus there, which is its own type of artwork?
Everybody loves the circus. It's not a hard sell. It's, some of the stuff, like, as you mentioned, that we do is new, is unusual. It's artists who are taking risks and experimenting and putting, sharing works that are in various stages of development. So, if you're curious about how theater and performance and dance gets made, this is, that's the place for you to be because you're right in there in the mix and an important part of it. That's not what everybody wants. Some people want to just go and see an amazing show. And so the circus definitely provides that bang for, your average, theater goer.
And Josh, how is it for you to have that type of audience participation there, I would say, or feedback? I mean, you get audience feedback at a regular show with applause and reaction, but like in this situation, you're there to workshop it in a way.
Yeah, I mean, audience reactions are super, super key. Like I know, of course, when you see the juggler juggle 9 balls, it's going to blow your mind. But with all the storytelling components, with the clowning components, it's the first time any of that is being tested in front of an audience, and hopefully they laugh. But if they don't laugh, then we have another week or so to fine-tune it before it hits the road, and we can't really change it too much more after that. But the thing also is that the circus is naturally a community gathering event. That's just what it's always been. It brings out the whole town. The town pauses and comes and sees the show together, and you have 10-week-year-old babies. You have 99-year-old great-grandparents there at the same time. And, you want to get reactions from every kind of person so you know what to anticipate on the road.
in your experience and with your wife as well and her background in musical theater, can you talk a little bit about putting together a show? I mean, when you talk about a circus, as you said, people come with the idea of lions and, you know, trapeze artists and fire and clowns. But there's a storyline and there's an art. Can you talk about the mechanics and the producing and writing of this event?
Sure. So we usually start with music, where we're listening to songs and thinking, like, what is the sound of a show we'd be interested in? My brother's a professional musician and our composer, so he writes our music. You usually do an open casting call sometime in September where circus artists from all around the world apply to be in our show the following year. So then we get a sense of what's the music sounding like, who do we have, and then Lindsay and I discuss, like, what do we want to talk about this year? Like, what's important to us? What's going on? And we'll usually write a very basic story. You know, circus is not like a play or musical with lots of text and very specific thing you're trying to say. We're trying to be more broad and let people put their own version of the story onto our circus. And then in the winter, we paint our trucks and trailers. We get things ready. We do mini versions of rehearsals. We order our new concessions trailer or whatever it is, and do a lot of visas. We have 5 artists from around the world, from Argentina, Switzerland, the Netherlands, Germany. So that takes a whole bit of process, just getting international folks in. And you know, we have a lighting designer, costume designer, sound designer. So there's always these meetings beforehand where you're trying to figure out, what are we going to do with the design elements? Are they going to be ready? Are they not? Actually, today the costume designer is doing costume fittings, which means she's made all the costumes and now everything needs to be tailored for all the artists individually.
You mentioned as we started that this is a relatively new experience for you, but a long-term goal, long-held goal. Are you loving circus life?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I always wanted to escape real life to do circus life. I would leave high school early and come back late in order to participate in this youth circus that I was in. I mean, I have 2 kids, a 3-year-old and a 2-year-old, who are on tour living in our trailer. So they're getting what I always wanted, which was growing up on the circus lot as multi-generational. But it's super fun. It's not the easiest thing, of course, because you're not at home. You're always traveling. You're living, you know, in a field with lots of other people. But it's extremely rewarding, and it's, like you said, it's a goal I've visualized my whole life, so getting to live it out is just awesome.
Well, there's got to be something so wonderful also about that communal experience, not only with the troupe that you're traveling with, but when that troupe lands in a town and then sets up and presents to the community, as you said, like, people always want to come to the circus or see the circus. So great. You're probably the coolest parents ever, I have to say.
Maybe. Depends. My friends who were circus parents, either their kids end up running their business or they run as far away from the business as possible.
Brett, let's remind folks the details of Friday night.
Yes, you can get tickets for the show at nacl.org. They are available. We have 3 different seating levels, starting at $20 for general seating, where you bring your own seat. Lawn chair or blanket, whatever you like. And then we actually have fixed seating in 2 different tiers. So there's a premium level seat, and then there's the VIP
front row.
Right front and center, if you want it all big
see
and alive.
The tiers of the sad clap.
Exactly.
Are you still looking for volunteers?
We actually got all the volunteers that we need, which is fabulous. Thanks to the Upper Delaware Community Network for that.
All right, great. Thank you guys for being here and have fun at the circus on Friday. This is Josh Avner from the circus, Hideaway Circus, and their new show preview of Canvas Sky at NACL Friday in Highland Lake. And thanks to Brett Kaiser of NACL.
Thank you, Tim.
Thanks for having us.
All right, that's all for this edition of Radio Chatskill. You can hear this episode, past episodes, and all of our local programming at our website, wjffradio.org. I'm Tim Bruno. Thanks for listening.
Support for Radio Catskill comes from Farm Arts Collective, located on Willow Wisp Organic Farm in Damascus, Pennsylvania. Farm Arts Collective's programs intersect the practices of farming, performance, food, and ecology. FarmArtsCollective.org. From the Community Foundation of Orange and Sullivan, a publicly supported philanthropic institution, CFOSNY.org. And from listeners like you, who donate at WJFFradio.org.
Hey there, I'm Cassie of Rare Pair Radio. It's a weekly showcase of primarily female artists, but also a wide range of avant-garde musicians. I will be playing the fruit of post-punk, experimental, and fringe music, only on WJFF Radio Catskill. Don't you be no villain. You got to love. Rare Pair Radio, Friday at 8 p.m.
Music from a musician's perspective. I'm Kathy Geary, and on Now and Then, we explore the artistry of the singer-songwriter. Now and Then, Saturday afternoons at 3 on Radio Catskill. Listen local.
WJFF Jeffersonville. Streaming online at wjffradio.org. You're listening to Radio Catskill. Local news, culture, and NPR. Today's weather, there's an air quality alert in effect until 11 o'clock this evening. Air quality levels of the air predicted to be greater than for ozone and pollution levels elevated, according to the New York State Department of Health. Consider limiting strenuous outdoor physical activity today. High near 86.